The following talk was given by Norm Randolph at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on August 18, 2024. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming today. Today I was going to tell some stories about Buddha, the Buddha who lived in India. We started our way of life in this world. The Buddha was born about 2,500 years ago in northern India, and his given name was Siddhartha, and his family name was Gautama. So he was born Siddhartha Gautama, and his mother died shortly after he was born, and he was raised by his stepmother. And his father was a powerful clan ruler, his father was hoping that his son Siddhartha would eventually grow up and become the clan ruler and follow in his footsteps. So Siddhartha was educated with that in mind. He received a very extensive education in how to run a clan government, and he also received a thorough education in the martial arts, because in those days, clan rulers were sometimes called upon to lead their troops into battle. So he was given this extensive martial arts education along with the governmental studies that he undertook. From a very early age, Siddhartha was very sensitive to the suffering that he saw in the world. There is a story about him. He and his cousin were out playing, and his cousin had a bow and arrow, and his cousin shot down a bird. And the bird fell to the ground with his wing flapping in great pain, and Siddhartha picked up the bird and tried to help it, and took the arrow out and tried to help the bird. But his cousin said, "That's my bird. I shot it." But Siddhartha wouldn't give him the bird. He was deeply moved by the suffering that the bird was going through. And so he took the bird home and nursed it back to health and took care of it until it was able to recover from the injury. And on another occasion where he showed his deep sensitivity to suffering was, this was during the spring planting festival. And during the spring planting festival, this was usually considered a very joyous occasion where they would plow the fields and sow the seeds. And this was usually considered a very joyful occasion, but for Siddhartha, it was not. It was a very painful experience for him to see what was going on here, because when the fields were plowed, all the little insects and worms that were living in the soil were exposed, and many of them were killed. And that brought about attacks by birds who saw the suffering little worms and bugs in the soil. And then bigger birds came and attacked the first group of birds that had came. And so Siddhartha saw this, what most people thought it was a very joyous occasion, as a opportunity for very sad things to take place and for lots of beings to be hurt. Also, Siddhartha noticed that situations of sickness, old age, and death And there didn't seem to be any escape from these situations. And this, he was very, very much concerned about this situation of sickness, old age, and death, that nobody seemed to be able to escape. And he thought about this a great deal. And his father was very worried that his son would get too caught up in all his thoughts about suffering. And so his father tried to distract him from the painful, difficult aspects of life. And his father tried to provide him with lots of pleasurable activities to be involved in so that he would be able to let go of his concern about the suffering of the world and just sit back and enjoy these pleasurable activities. So he was very much sheltered by his father in his youth, and very much offered opportunities for pleasurable activities to be carried out. And so in a sense, he seemed to have it pretty good. In one sense, he had all these pleasurable activities that his father arranged for him. And he was a very charming, good looking young man, highly intelligent, and people liked him very much, and they looked forward to the day when he would become the clan ruler. And so he seemed to have it in pretty good in one sense, but he was deeply concerned about the suffering that he saw in the world. And as he got older, he wondered more and more about this suffering. And he wondered about how he could live his life with peace and freedom, in this reality in which suffering showed up so much. So he continued to be concerned about the suffering he saw in the world. And at the age of 29, he left the life at the palace. He figured he couldn't really discover how to live his life in this world where so much suffering is by continuing to live in the luxurious lifestyle that he had at the palace. He decided he had to go seek a way of life where he could awaken to this life in which so much suffering took place. And so he left and took on the life of a homeless wanderer, a homeless monk. And he lived by begging for his food. People would offer him food donations, and he would live the life of a homeless wanderer, homeless beggar. And he studied with some of the best teachers of his time. Siddhartha very quickly mastered their meditation techniques and mastered their philosophies. But after he'd done this for a while, he was not satisfied with what he'd learned. He didn't feel that what he'd learned really taught him what he needed to know. It didn't give him the awakeness that he needed to function in this world where suffering showed up so much. So after he became dissatisfied with his teachers, he turned to the practice of asceticism. And with asceticism, the idea is to make your life very painful and difficult, denying yourself sleep and imposing hardships on yourself, and with the expectation that by imposing hardships on yourself and making your life more difficult, you would be able to have you'd be able to weaken your body and your bodily desires and be able to eventually awaken to the truth. So Siddhartha tried this practice of asceticism for a while. He practiced it very diligently, and he practiced it so diligently that he almost killed himself. He got to the point where he was hardly eating anything at all, going without sleep, inflicting painful situations on himself. And at one point, he collapsed and fell on the ground from weakness from all the ascetic practices that he'd been carrying out. And fortunately, a milkmaid discovered him, passed out on the ground, and she gave him milk and oats and helped to revive him. And over a period of several weeks, she would come see him every day, give him milk and oats, and try and nurse him back to health. And Siddhartha realized from this experience that the practice of asceticism was completely useless. And after this, Siddhartha came up with the practice of awareness here and now. This is a practice of awareness that is carried out in all circumstances. This is an awareness without being caught up in expectations and one-sided ideas and beliefs. It's an awareness that's carried out for the sake of being aware. It's the practice of being aware for the sake of being aware. This is the practice that he carried out. He didn't carry out his practice with the expectation of gaining something like he had previously, gaining something from the meditation techniques that his teachers had taught him, or gaining something from the practice of asceticism that he had engaged in. This was a practice that was without expectations of gain, and without being caught up in expectations, and without being caught up in one-sided ideas and beliefs about how life was. This was just a practice of being aware here and now for the sake of being aware here and now. And the practice of Zazen, which we carry out today, this is the most stable and peaceful form of this practice. And while Siddhartha, in all circumstances, Siddhartha tried to carry out this practice, being aware here and now, in all circumstances, as much as possible. And he experienced all kinds of things, all sorts of thoughts, feelings, emotions, desires. All of these things came up, but as much as possible, he tried to resume the practice of being aware here and now, just to be aware here and now. He didn't practice with the expectations of gaining something. Whenever he did get caught up in the practice of thinking he was going to gain something, he resumed the practice of being aware here and now, for the sake of being aware here and now. When he was caught up in his expectations and beliefs, he would resume the practice of being aware here and now for the sake of being aware here and now. He continually resumed this practice of being aware here and now for the sake of being aware here and now. And eventually, he had a very powerful awakening experience. He looked up at the morning star and suddenly realized what his life was. In this awakening, he realized that his true life, true self, his true nature was the Buddha nature, which is subjectless, objectless awareness or awakeness itself. It's the directly experienced awareness or awakeness, which is being experienced by all beings right now. This directly experienced here now reality, this is our true life, our true self, our true nature. This is the true life, true self, true nature of all beings. And there's nothing outside of it. It's everything is included within it. This is our true life. It became evident that all the seemingly separate beings were manifestations of this true life, true self, or true nature. The true life, true self, true nature of Buddha and each seemingly separate being was the life of all beings. This true life, true self, true nature is a reality of wholeness, totality, universal reality. It's the life of all beings. And our practice is ultimately to wholeheartedly live this life, wholeheartedly live this life without expectations, without being caught up in our one-sided ideas and beliefs. To live our life in this way helps all beings and allows all beings to help us and allows all beings to help all beings and to be helped by all beings. This is the life that we're living. Our practice is to live that life. So for the next 45 years, he was about 35 when he had this experience and realized this. For the next 45 years until his death at the age of 80, he tried to help his followers to eventually realize who they truly are and to help them live as they truly are. And to live as they truly are, or to live as the true self, is the essence of Buddhist practice. But our true self is usually ignored or overlooked, once again, because we're caught up in our dualistic, limited, one-sided views and ideas and beliefs, and caught up in expectations. And because of this, we act with egocentric intention, go off into lives of confusion. So our practice is to see and let go of how what we truly are, or what the true self is ignored, and to fully live as the true self. The true self can't be seen objectively or understood conceptually, but it's directly experienced here and now, and everything is a manifestation of it. It's not something that is hidden. It's being experienced right now, but we usually ignore this reality that's being experienced right now and get caught up and our limited views and expectations of what our life is. But ultimately, this is a reality that can't be hidden, seems to be hidden. We don't know what it is, but it's right here. It's just we tend to ignore it. So our practice is to see and let go of how it's ignored and really live this life. So, and Buddha in his teachings taught that all beings are interdependent, living inseparably. In our practice, we try to take care of all the seemingly separate beings without being taken in by the belief that they actually are separate beings, and without being taken in by the belief that all these seemingly separate beings who are all living one life, we don't get caught up in an idea of oneness either. Try to avoid getting caught up in any ideas of oneness or multiplicity, existence, non-existence, whatever ideas or dichotomies we get caught up in, we try to see when that's going on. and just allow our tendency to get caught up in these dualistic, one-sided, limited ideas and categories, allow it to drop away by itself. In this practice, it can be directly realized for living inseparably from all beings. This isn't an idea to grasp, but it's a reality that can be directly experienced here and now. Since we're inseparable from all beings to hurt, since we're inseparable from all beings to hurt others is to hurt ourselves, and to help others is to help ourselves. Realizing our inseparability from all beings, this is the basis of compassion. Our life is inseparable from all beings, and we realize that an attitude of compassion arises. And realizing that each seemingly separate being is a manifestation of this incomparably great reality, this great beyond comparison reality, which is our true life, realizing that each seemingly separate being is a manifestation of that is the basis of respect for all beings, based beyond our usual idea of respect. Respect based on actual direct experience of who we and all beings are. So Buddha had a teaching of the three pure precepts. The three pure precepts, the way that they're most usually expressed is avoid what is unwholesome, do what is wholesome, purify your mind. This mind here is not the mind of a separate ego self. This mind is our true life, our true self. And the practice of purifying the mind is seeing and letting go of how the inherent purity of our mind, our true self, is ignored. Our true mind or true self is absolutely inherently pure. There's nothing outside of it or nothing in dualistic relationship to it that could make it impure. But yet we ignore this by getting caught up in our dualistic limited views and assumptions about how reality is. We ignore the inherent purity of our true life or true mind and get up caught up in lives of confusion. So the three pure precepts: avoid what is unwholesome, avoid what ignoring of wholeness. A practice is to see when wholeness is being ignored. Wholeness is another way of looking at what our true life is. Do what is wholesome. Live this life of wholeness and see and let go of how this wholeness is ignored. This is the three pure precepts. And Buddha also had a list of prohibitory precepts, and these included a list of activities that should be avoided. And these include killing, stealing, lying, satisfying desires in a harmful way, slandering others, abusing others, being greedy, being boastful, overindulging in intoxicants, and harboring hatred, anger, and ill will towards others. In these activities, we're caught up in the idea of being a separate ego self who's trying to gain advantage over other separate beings. It's very evident that we're caught up in our in ignoring our actual direct experience. And these prohibitory precepts and this list of precepts that I just read, or activities that I just read, these are not commandments. These are pointers to help us see when we're ignoring who we truly are, helping us to see that we're ignoring who we truly are. We're thinking, I'm a separate ego self. I want to gain advantage over this other separate ego self. I think I'll lie to him. I think I'll steal from him. I think I'll abuse him in some way. It's very clear that these activities point to ways in which we ignore who we truly are. They're not commandments. They're not, Buddha said, thou shalt not do this. Buddha doesn't want to make them commandments. He wants to make them pointers or teachings to help us see what our, to see when our life is being ignored so we can resume the practice of living as we truly are, and thereby helping ourselves and all beings. Buddha, in his teachings, frequently mentioned that the reason there's so much suffering and confusion in the world is because we usually overlook or ignore our interdependence with others. And also, we overlook that nothing remains the same, even for a moment. In actual direct experience, nothing separate or persisting can be found that could be grasped. And this is usually overlooked or ignored, and people usually live their lives trying to chase after and grasp ungraspable things and situations, and caught up in expectations and one-sided ideas and beliefs. This is how we end up living lives of confusion. Buddha strongly encouraged his followers in the practice of direct here now awareness. He encouraged them to live their lives based on this here now awareness, rather than living their lives based on their expectations, preconceived ideas, and one-sided beliefs. In this practice of here now awareness, it can be directly realized that our true self is this awareness or awakeness itself. Usually we think of it as I, separate ego self, me, I'm doing something in particular called being aware or awake. But in this practice of your now awareness, it can be eventually realized that awareness or awakeness is actually what we are. This is a subjectless, objectless awareness or awakeness. It's our true life. Buddha wanted people to try and live this life and let go of all the confusion that they usually have. Well, Buddha taught in many ways. He tried to help each being he met. He tried to help them appropriately. So he didn't teach the same way in all circumstances. Sometimes he adjusted his teaching to help a particular individual who is caught up in some particular way. And there are several examples of this. There was an example of a person who had become one of his monks, And this person was named Sona, and before he had become a monk, he had been a lute player. And the lute is a stringed instrument somewhat similar to a harp. And Sona had been an expert lute player. And Buddha knew this about him. But Sona was very dedicated to try and hurry up and attain awakening in his practice as soon as possible. And he had the expectation that the harder he tried to in his practice, and the more difficult he put on himself, the quicker he would attain awakening. So he would he had kind of a struggling and straining kind of practice. He would make things more difficult for himself, kind of like the practice of asceticism that Buddha practiced and eventually realized the worthlessness of when he first started out. But Sona, he would sometimes he would not wear his sandals, even though there were rocky areas with sharp rocks. He would walk over the rocks, and his feet would get badly cut up because he wasn't wearing his sandals. And he thought that this would speed up his path of attaining awakening. And so he was walking around. The other monks didn't have this idea. They would put on sandals when they came to area with rocky ground and sharp rocks. But Sona, he, in order to speed up his progress, he engaged in this ascetic practice, and he walked around with bloody feet. But eventually he got discouraged. He didn't seem to notice any improvement. And he started thinking, gosh, I'm not making any improvement here. Maybe I should give this practice up. And Buddha was very much in tune with others' feelings, and he could sense discouragement on Sona's part. And he went up to Sona one day and said, "Sona, you were thinking about quitting, weren't you?" And Sona said, "Yes, I was. I'm getting very discouraged. I'm practicing very hard, making a huge effort, but I'm not making the progress I'd hoped to make." And Buddha said, "Well, you were once a great lute player. And let me ask you a question. When the lute strings are tuned too tightly, does the lute make a good sound?" Sona said, "No. When the lute strings are tuned too tightly, the lute does not make a good sound." And Buddha asked, "When the lute strings are not tuned tightly enough, does the lute make a good sound?" And Sona said, "No, when the lute strings are not tuned tightly enough, the lute does not make a good sound. The lute only makes a good sound when the lute is tuned just right." And Buddha said, "In the same way, when you're in your practice, your effort must be just right. Your effort must be in harmony with reality as it is. Not caught up in your expectations of gain and improvement, not caught up in your limited ideas of what your life is. Just totally living your life as it is without being caught up in these limited ways. Living your life in harmony with reality. That is living your life just right." So Sona was very grateful to Buddha and was able to follow his advice, and eventually went on to become one of Buddha's very, very good monks. And there's another story. I've told this a number of times here about a lady who whose baby had died, and she was in a deep state of grief about this. She had, because of her deep grief, she'd gone temporarily insane, and she could not acknowledge the death of her baby. She continued to carry her baby around with her, and she could not admit that her baby had died. Her grief and temporary insanity had prevented her from acknowledging that. People would say to her, "Your baby is dead. You should go bury your baby." But the woman said, "My baby is not dead. My baby just needs the right medicine. So I need to get the right medicine to help my baby." But it was clear that wasn't going to help. It was clear she was deeply afflicted with her grief and temporary insanity. So eventually someone suggested that she go see the Buddha. And the Buddha said to her, when she said she needed medicine for her baby, the Buddha said to her, "For medicine, you should go to a house in the village where no one has died and collect mustard seeds from that house in the village where no one has died. And by giving your baby those mustard seeds, you can restore the life of the baby." So Jessica Tommy was very grateful to hear this. I just said, "There's something I can do to save my baby." And so she went to all the different houses in the village, but at every, and she asked for the mustard seeds. First she asked, "Has someone died at this house?" At every house, they said, "Yes, someone has died here." She wanted to get mustard seeds from a house where no one had died, but she couldn't find a house where no one had died. And eventually, she did this very diligently and with great effort. And Buddha had given her an activity to be involved in to help her let go of her temporary insanity and to let go of the deep grief she was feeling, and to help her realize that it's impossible to escape from death. So Buddha really helped out Kisa Gotami. She was able to let go of her insanity and deep grief, and was able to bury her baby. And later on, she was so grateful to Buddha for the highly appropriate help that he offered her that she later became one of his nuns, and she became a very dedicated follower of the Buddha's. So in Buddha's teaching, he encouraged questions. He didn't want people to blindly accept the teachings that he offered. He didn't want people to immediately reject the teachings he'd offered. He wanted people to see these teachings as pointers. So he wanted people to reflect on his teachings and to ask questions. Whatever Buddha says, can't exactly say it. We can't exactly pin down conceptually or explain what it is. So Buddha didn't want people to grasp at words, but he wanted them to carefully consider and question what he said, and to see whatever he said as pointers or teachings, to help them see where they were confused, and to help them see where they could let go and live as they truly were. So many people became Buddhist followers, and I think that was because he so deeply realized his interdependence with others. Because of that, he had a very peaceful and kind-hearted presence, and others could feel his peacefulness and compassion and respect. People were very much drawn to him. Then many people wanted to practice with him and study with him. And he was not in competition with other religions. He didn't want to be in competition with them. But yet many people from other religions would leave the other religions to become his followers. But Buddha didn't want to be in competition with them. He didn't want a large number of blind followers. He wanted people who would follow him for the right reasons. So there's one story in which a practitioner of another religion engaged Buddha in a debate. And Buddha spoke to the person, and the person tried to emphasize how his religion was better. But in the midst of this discussion, this person realized that he wanted to become one of Buddha's followers. He suddenly saw that Buddha's way of life was a way of life that he wanted to do, and he wanted to give up his old religion. So he said, I want to become one of your followers. And Buddha said, yes, you can become one of my followers. But you are a person who has given many donations to the followers of your religion. You've given them, you've supported many of the practitioners of it. If you were to quit supporting them, many of them would suffer great hardship and go through a great deal of difficulty. So you can become one of my followers, but please continue to support the members of your religion and support the activities of them. Please continue to do that. And on that condition, you can become one of my followers. There's another person who is debating with the Buddha. And it was said, because Buddha was so successful in bringing people to his religion, that he cast a magic spell over people. And this one practitioner from another religion said, is it true that you cast a magic spell over people, and that's how you get so many people to quit their religions and come and join your religion? And Buddha said, no, I don't cast a magic spell over people. So this person from another religion continued to debate Buddha, and eventually he realized, I want to become one of Buddha's followers. I want to join his religion. I deeply feel that's what I need. I feel he's the teacher for me. And he told Buddha that. He said, I want to join your religion and leave my religion. And Buddha said, wait a minute. Didn't you express concern that I cast a magic spell over people and made them join my religion? How do you know I haven't cast a magic spell over you? And the person replied to Buddha, well, maybe you have cast a magic spell on me, but I don't care. I so much want to be one of your practitioners. I don't care if you didn't cast a magic spell on me. I really want to be one of your close students. Please let me be one. So anyway, people were really drawn to him. Beings that were violent or cruel or had lots of aggressiveness, even beings like that were influenced by him by being in his presence. Aggressiveness and anger and fear and these beings could drop away, and they could be peaceful in the presence of Buddha. And some angry individuals who live very violent lives were able to see a new direction in which to go just by being in the presence of the Buddha. So, after Buddha's death, his teachings spread throughout the rest of India and throughout Asia. And since since the 19th century, or since the 20th century, Buddha's teachings have been spreading around the world, through America, Europe, and many other parts of the world. Do you have any questions about any of this? It's almost time to wrap it up, so I should probably stop pretty soon. Any questions you had? Yes, Mary.
And maybe a stupid question. Why was the Buddha so reluctant to admit women into the order or as his followership?
Yeah, that's a question that it's not completely answered. I think that part of it was it would be hard for women to go into the homeless lifestyle, and that's, I think, mainly due to the nefariousness of men who would prey upon them. And I think that it might have been difficult for people at that time to accept women coming into the Sangha. It might have made it more difficult for him to have people come in. But he was asked the question, if women take up this way of life, can they attain realization and practice the way? And Buddha said, yes, they can. There's no gap between men and women. I think the fact that he refused, or that he didn't allow women right away, was more due to the conditions that were prevalent in the society at that time, not due to lack of capability on the part of women. Because he very clearly stated women have it, they're completely capable in awakening, completely capable of carrying out this way of life.
Which was not typical, was it?
That's right. Many other religions did not.
That women
didn't have that. Enough. Yeah, they would not have come
awakened
up with that at all. Yeah. That's right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Well, another question. Okay.
Yeah, I just had a quick question for you, Norm. Thank you for your talk. I had a friend of mine who was kind of familiar with these teachings and practice somewhat asked me a question. And I think you answered it through the course of your talk with the story of Sona in particular, but I'm just curious what your answer to this would be. Basically, his question was, isn't progress and striving towards improvement in one's life, isn't that going to help the practice of awareness? You know,
it seems like it. But ultimately, who's making progress? Is there some particular ego self who's making progress? It doesn't deny the conventional appearance of progress. We see that people progress in their Zen practice. Looks like the progress. Ultimately, is there progress? Can't find a separate individual who makes progress. But yet this reality shows up as looks like separate individuals. We're making progress. We don't deny the conventional common sense appearance. We don't deny the reality that is beyond the conventional appearance. We don't tell people, come here to Dharma Field, you won't make any progress. We don't tell people. Well, I do, but most people don't. But we need to be able to see reality in terms of how it appears conventionally and in terms of beyond conventional appearances, beyond any ideas or beliefs or assumptions we can have. So it seems like appearance, seems like progress, but who's making this progress? Never.
Sorry, my fault. Correct me if I'm wrong. But doesn't progress imply staticness because you have something fixed here and then at some indeterminate time later, you have some fixed thing here, you compare them and you say, oh, progress.
Right.
So it implies a certain lack of fluidity.
Right.
Of emptiness.
That's right.
It's a denial, really, of emptiness.
Yeah.
Would you say that's?
Yeah, it's who progresses, you know?
Yeah.
What is it that's progressing?
Yeah.
But yet, looks like progress. We don't deny that appearance.
Yeah.
We don't deny this ultimate absolute reality in which can't find progress, but yet conventionally looks like progress. They're not two different realities. They're one reality. Our practice is to live them, not ignoring conventional appearances or throwing it out, but not getting caught up in them either. And not getting caught by some idea of absolute or ultimate. Just living this life without grasping it at one-sided views. Okay, is that good, man? Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I probably shouldn't wrap it up here. I'd like to mention something. Some of you know, a very wonderful person, member of our community, Paul Courtney died last Tuesday, and he's a very wonderful person. I think very highly of him, and I know that those of you who know him also feel that way about him. So when we at the end of the lecture, Usually we chant the four vows. So maybe at the end, when we chant the four vows, those of you who knew Paul and remember him, maybe you could think of him. When you chant the four vows, a very wonderful person. I feel very lucky to have known him. I know many other people do too. So I guess we can chant the four vows.
Let us recite the four vows.
To save all sentient beings, they are numberless. Of their inexhaustible, of their teachings, of their boundless, live a little way, though it is unsurpassable.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.